This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Not for the first time, and probably not for the last, I make this observation. That financial crisis we had 10 years ago, it's going to be with this economy for a very long time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 22nd of May today, Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We've got some stuff coming up in the second half of the program about the financial crisis, about how it changed this economy in ways we are still feeling 10 years on. But we're going to begin with one of the proximate causes of that crisis, the American banking system and regulatory oversight thereof. Today, the House passed a bill to dial back some of the banking regulations put in place after the financial crisis. Dodd-Frank is the name you're going to know. Today's bill, already passed by the Senate, raises the threshold at which banks will be considered big banks, systemically important financial institutions, if you want to get technical. It'll also reduce some mortgage lending reporting requirements as well. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us up to speed.
In the decades since the financial crisis, there have been thousands of regulations to rein in the banks and financial sector. Christopher Mitchell studies financial crises at Mount Holyoke College.
In the aftermath of a financial crisis, everyone wants to take risk off the table.
He says these kinds of regulatory pushes follow a predictable pattern.
Once a decade or so has gone by without any crises, people start to get an appetite to add a little more risk in.
By taking some of those regulations out. But in theory, all these Dodd-Frank regulations made our banks more resilient, right?
There is clear evidence that banks are better prepared to withstand losses than they were in 2008.
Diego Zuluaga is with the Cato Institute, but not everything is fixed.
The idea that, you know, certain financial institutions are just so enormous in size that their failure would just be too damaging to be tolerated, that remains a problem.
A problem this new legislation doesn't really fix. Anat Admati at the Stanford Graduate School of Business is skeptical that our financial system is actually in better shape.
The financial crisis is dangerously out of sight, and we seem to forget. So when the next one comes, we'll be surprised again and we'll say, oops, just like we said last time.
She worries this bill is the beginning of a larger rollback that might set us up for trouble down the road. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today's corporate story comes to us with this tagline: maybe there really only are so many people in this economy who can run a big company. Lowe's, the home improvement big box, announced today it's got a new CEO. Retailer JCPenney is on the losing end of that transaction. Marvin Ellison, who's been running Penney since 2014, is making a move. Ellison's had a mostly good couple of years in that retail company, improving its digital presence and bringing big brands into the store. But Lowe's brings him back to his home improvement roots with an eye on leveraging his experience to beat back his former employer, Home Depot. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on what this move might mean for both Penney and Lowe's in a complicated retail environment.
When Marvin Ellison got to JCPenney, things were decidedly not going well. His job was to somehow stem a two-year sales decline. And according to retail analyst Carol Speakerman, he did that. Kinda.
Ellison has a track record of narrowing performance gaps, but not necessarily setting the world on fire.
But the venerable Penney's he was taking over was in the midst of dealing with its own dumpster fire. Foot traffic in malls already declining for a decade. And former CEO Ron Johnson's ambitious rebrand strategy, that led to the company's shares falling by more than half. Barbara Kahn teaches marketing at the Wharton School of Business.
And the Ron Johnson damage was so bad because it was a critical time for department stores. So there was real hope that Ellison could bring back things that would make JCPenney whole again.
His transition to president and CEO of Lowe's is something of a homecoming across the street for Ellison. Before joining Penney's, he spent 12 years at Lowe's biggest competitor, Home Depot. Lowe's understands that Home Depot dominates distribution, but Lowe's has an innovation lab. Customers can already use augmented reality goggles in the aisles to try out new equipment. And Barbara Kahn at the Wharton School says Ellison is likewise digitally inclined.
So they have this opportunity to stay ahead of the curve, you know, and to compete in a realistic way. I think JCPenney was always playing catch-up.
Ellison will take over at Lowe's on July 2nd. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Tuesday, you remember the happy music from yesterday? Yeah, it's not going to be that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We intentionally didn't lead the program with trade and China today because you just need a break from all of that every now and then, right? But also because there are only so many twists and turns in the U.S.-China trade story that it's easy to get distracted. Fact of the matter is, though, that there's a whole lot of trade news going on across the other big ocean. Our relationship with the European Union is turning increasingly bitter over those steel and aluminum tariffs, also because of the American sanctions against European companies that do business with Iran. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
For the past few weeks, Europe hasn't sounded too conciliatory. The EU has condemned US attempts to force a reduction of European steel exports as blackmail. And one of the EU's most senior officials, Donald Tusk, last week delivered a stinging rebuke to Europe's most important ally.
With friends like that, who needs enemies?
The EU will not negotiate with a gun at its head, says Agathe Desmarais of the Economist Intelligence Unit in London. It will not make concessions in the hope that its temporary exemption from the US steel tariffs will be made permanent. Europe is seething, and not just about steel.
It has strengthened its rhetoric in recent days. Know that the US is also reimposing sanctions against Iran that could hurt European companies.
French oil giant Total, Danish shipping firm Møller-Mærsk, and German electronics company Siemens have all indicated they'll pull out of Iran rather than risk US sanctions. The French have called on the EU to compensate the companies to keep them in Iran. But, says Desmarais, it's a futile move.
The EU doesn't have the financial resources to compensate companies hit by US sanctions.
Which only serves to increase the EU's frustration. But not all trade experts are pessimistic about Europe and the US settling their differences over trade.
The Chinese compromise came out of nowhere, so in a way, who can tell until one gets to the crunch in these negotiations?
Professor Jim Rollo of the UK Trade Policy Observatory thinks it is possible the EU will give ground on steel.
The EU might buy into voluntary export restraints.
But as he watches the back and forth of President Trump's negotiating technique, the hardball-softball routine, Rollo confesses,
I'm confused and I don't think I'm alone in that as to what the likely outcomes here are.
All may become clearer a week from Friday when Europe's temporary exemption from the steel tariffs expires. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Mark Zuckerberg continued his apology tour today, spending a couple hours testifying before the European Parliament in Brussels about Cambridge Analytica et al. This is a big week, actually, for data privacy over in Europe. The EU's much-ballyhooed General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, as it's known, goes into effect on Friday. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech, also my partner on the podcast we do together called Make Me Smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so make me smart on this. See what I did there? Make me smart on this whole Zuckerberg testimony thing. How'd it go for him in front of the European Parliament?
You know, it went not dissimilar to how it went here in the United States. You know, Zuckerberg essentially issued the same apology he issued before Congress in the U.S. You know, it's interesting because it was a very odd format that limited the opportunity, I think, for Zuckerberg to mess up and for the testimony or the conversation to make news. It was not testimony, which I think is important. The lawmakers asked all their questions at once and asked Mark Zuckerberg to answer them all at the end, which I think almost let him stick to his talking points a little bit more. It was very clear that the members of the EU Parliament were not happy at all with the answers that they did eventually get.
Well, that's funny, right? Because it plays to his strength, because he was really, I mean, he did answer questions before Congress, but he was really formulaic, right? He was very stick. He was well briefed, shall we say, when he was put in front of Congress.
Exactly. And you can imagine that if he had 25 minutes to essentially give the same speech, but in speech form and not answer form, that's basically what happened.
Right. We're still waiting to see what Congress is going to do about this. What are the prospects for anything coming out of Europe on Facebook in response to this specific issue in the testimony?
You know, the European Parliament has no actual power in this case. And so it would have to move back to lawmakers in a sort of circuitous route. So it's likely that there won't be anything immediately. That does not mean that the European Union won't at some point move to regulate Facebook. They were, like I said, not happy with these answers on data and privacy. Several of them indicated they think Facebook is a monopoly. And then, of course, as you mentioned, there's the GDPR, which is in effect with enforcement powers as of Friday. That opens Facebook up to potential fines if the EU finds it is violating rules about how users can control or access their data. And it could enable new lawsuits around data collection and, of course, government investigation.
So since you mentioned GDPR, and I do want to ask you about it, but and not that I'm checking my email here in the studio, but literally about 3 minutes ago, before we went to you, I got an email from Spotify, and it said, updates to Spotify privacy policy. Here's the quote. We are contacting you today to let you know that we'll be making some changes to our privacy policy because of the European Union General Data Protection Regulation. That's what's going on here, right? All these privacy policy updates that we're seeing in our inboxes are because of what's happening in Europe.
That's what's happening. It's a little ironic that it feels like spam because part of the GDPR part of the GDPR requires companies to get consent before they communicate with you or use your data. But because it requires all companies who deal with citizens in the EU, they have to be more transparent and upfront about how they're using your data, what they're collecting. And they're supposed to let you know that you have these rights to either access your information, erase it, correct it, or move it to another service, like from Facebook to Flickr. Yeah. In the short term, that means you're going to get a lot of emails.
I should say here, Molly and I are going to do a special Make Me Smart that's going to drop Thursday afternoon about GDPR and all of that good stuff. In like the 15 seconds we have left, Molly, let me ask you this. How desperately are companies going to try to get around these rules?
I think pretty desperately. I think some of the smaller companies are hoping that the focus will be on the bigger guys.
Yeah. Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, and with me, a podcast we do that's called Make Me Smart. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. See ya. Coming up.
My goal was, okay, when I graduate college, my first job, I need to make at least $75,000. At least.
Not exactly what happened. The class of 2008, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back some of yesterday's gains, as I said, falling 0.7%, 178 on the point scale, closed at 24,834. S&P 500 down 0.3%, 8 points, 27.24. NASDAQ also down 0.2%, 15 points, 73.78. Bank stocks climbed as Congress, as we told you, is moving to ease some banking regulations. J.P. Morgan Chase gained about 0.75%. Bank of America picked up about 0.1%. Hard to know what's going on with the Chinese phone maker ZTE after the president seemed to contradict reports of a deal with the U.S. that would keep ZTE alive. He did that today in the Oval Office, sitting next to the South Korean president. American companies that supply parts to ZTE are interested parties in that drama. Chipmaker Qualcomm lost a little more than 0.5% today. The CEO of Qualcomm, by the way, on this program tomorrow. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is a good year to be a college senior graduating into the American labor market. Unemployment's at record lows. Companies are looking for people to hire, and there are jobs to be had. 9 years ago, though, with the economy still on the way to the bottom of the recession, it was a different story. In May of 2009, the unemployment rate was 9.4%. President Obama gave his first college commencement speech at Arizona State University that year, and after the pleasantries, he got right to the point.
The economy remains in the midst of a historic recession, the worst we've seen since the Great Depression. The result, in part, of greed and irresponsibility that rippled out from Wall Street and Washington as we spent beyond our means and failed to make hard choices.
our project about how the financial crisis changed this country. And today, the prospects of those recession graduates is called Divided Decade. Michael Crow is the president of Arizona State University. He introduced President Obama at that 2009 commencement. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So I'll tell you what, I just went back and I watched the video of President Obama's commencement address in 2009 at ASU. And I was watching mostly your introduction, actually. And you gave him a nice long windup and you were very complimentary. But you said some things that were interesting that I want to pick up on here. You talked about education as a civic duty, as a responsibility, and how you were going to keep that up. And what I want to talk about is, at about the time the president gave that speech, the Arizona legislature decided to cut funding for ASU and education in that state quite a bit. And I want to know what was going through your mind in the spring of 2009 as the recession was hitting the bottom.
Well, you know, what was going on then in 2009 was we were in the beginning of a big shift, and we needed to figure our way through this big shift.
It had been a pretty good run for you at ASU up to that point. I mean, you had grown, tuition had gone up, you'd increased investment, and then it all came to a screeching halt.
Well, what came to a screeching halt was the public's willingness to continue to invest in higher education on a model that they had been used to from the past. And so what we had to figure out in 2008 and 2009 and 2010 was, how do we move forward on a completely new model?
So what is that model? Because, you know, tuition's gone up and state funding has stayed lower than it was. How are you doing this and serving the people of Arizona where, as you said, the economy has changed so drastically in the past 10 years?
So for us, what we've done is we abandoned what I call the public agency model of a university, where you run like the government, you run like a department of the government, you wait for the government to invest in the institution, and then you adjust your cost structure a little bit, and then you have some tuition to sort of balance out your expenses. And so we moved away from public agency to what we call public enterprise. By public enterprise, that means more partnerships, more alliances, and then shifting the emphasis of the state toward funding the student and not funding the university.
Yeah, but the students are still paying tuition, right?
The students are paying tuition, but you know, our hope is that, you know, where we can end up is that the state can invest in helping the students to be able to attend the university. Arizona is one of a few states that doesn't have much state-based financial aid. So we're trying to change the model from the university being an agency of the government providing a public service to the university being a public enterprise to which people come, for which if they can't afford to come, then they get assistance to be able to come.
So given all that, and I hear you, but it is now more necessary than ever, right, to have a college degree to ensure some kind of economic stability in your life. And at the same time, higher education costs so much more now. How do you rationalize that value proposition?
Well, the value proposition is an important one. First, you're right that we really need to get 90% of the population through high school. Of the 90% that finish high school, most states are now moving to what they call 60% attainment goals. Hmm. So what they mean by attainment, post-secondary attainment, some kind of technical degree, technical certificate, associate's degree, or a bachelor's degree, that's what will be needed as, in a sense, proxies for a person's ability to adapt to a rapidly changing economy. Hmm. Here's a statistic that people ought to be aware of, and that is, half or slightly more than half of the people in the U.S. that ever started college never finished. Hmm. It becomes more manageable if you have expense associated with going to college, if you have a dramatic return on your investment. If you don't graduate, you don't have that return on the investment at the same level. We've measured our return on investment. It's 12% on average. So we think the value proposition, as you described it, is very positive.
Let me use you as a proxy for all those other public university presidents out there who I imagine spend a lot of time in front of state legislatures testifying on this, that, and the other. Do you see a day when public investment in higher education will be back to not even where it should be, but where it was 10 or 15 years ago?
I think what people are going to realize is that there's huge potential now to move the economy in a new direction, but that it's going to require people to be educated at a slightly different level than they were educated in the past. What that will mean then is that it will be in the best interest of every state to have the most capable workforce. And states will now begin, as they are increasingly, competing over workforce issues. Seven of the sites that Amazon is looking at for the placement of their next headquarters are in high-tax zones between Metro Boston and Metro Washington. It turns out that what they're after is human capital. wiser state legislatures will see that and make those investments to help to be able to ensure that competitiveness.
Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State University. Michael, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
There were lots of other big names who made commencement speeches in the midst of that recession. Ellen DeGeneres, Jamie Dimon from JPMorgan Chase, a guy named Ben Bernanke as well. You can see what advice they gave those recession graduates on our website. It's marketplace.org. The thing about graduating into a recession like the one this country went through 10 years ago is that it's not just those first couple of years out of school that can be tough. You pay the price for that bad timing you had for years. Marketplace's Scott Tong went to Arkansas to talk to some members of the class of 2008.
When Luis Calderon graduated from the University of Central Arkansas back in 2008, he had the immigrant dreams of his whole family on his shoulders.
I studied economics with emphasis in international trade.
His story starts at St. Mary's Catholic School in a modest part of town. He took me there to the playground.
I had that thing that had a ball catch.
Tennis ball.
Yeah, that was hard for me.
He enrolled here at the age of 13 when his family moved from Guatemala. His father gave up a high-end government job back home with fancy lunches and a chauffeur to be the school janitor. Embarrassing.
You know, some of the kids were like, "Who's that?" He's like, "Oh, it's my dad. He's cleaning the bathroom." Yeah. And I wouldn't even want to go to the bathroom because he was in there cleaning.
The family became naturalized citizens, and Luis went on to the University of Central Arkansas, a semi-selective public school in the South. And the whole plan was that the family investment would have a return, a diploma, and a good job for Luis Calderon.
My goal was, okay, when I graduate college, my first job, I need to make at least $75,000. At least.
As a senior, this econ major figured he'd work at a multinational bank or telecom company and wear fancy suits and fancy planes. And then, in the spring of 2008, the bank Bear Stearns went under and the financial system tanked. And by graduation, when he and his friends sang the alma mater at the University of Central Arkansas, the economy was losing 229,000 jobs per month. All he could find was a local bank teller gig.
I was making about $10.25 an hour, so we could do the math. $28,000 a year.
Okay.
Let's see. About $22,000, $23,000 a year.
When you graduate into a recession, several studies suggest the damage can be lasting. You make less than your non-recession friends, and you don't catch up for 10, even 20 years, depending on how deep the recession is. Some people never catch up, says economist Philip Oriopoulos at the University of Toronto.
We certainly find a significant fraction of graduates that are permanently affected. And even for those that are not, they do come off quite worse off over the lifetime.
As far as earnings over a lifetime, several studies find recession grads can make $60,000 to $100,000 less than their luckier peers. How's that? Well, in general, they start out in lousy first jobs and they get stuck.
Not only did they end up with lower wages, but they ended up in firms that tended to be smaller and tended to pay less.
Arkansas is one of the poorest states. And in the Great Recession, its job market bounced back more slowly than the rest of the country. Still, Luis Calderon tried to move up at the bank. He applied to be a loan officer, at which point the interviewer told him.
He said, "Well, Luis, the people in our area are used to seeing a certain kind of individual. And I don't know that you fit that mold."
And this is what that mold meant.
He said, maybe in a couple of years where the Hispanic market is a little bigger, that can help you. So that's when it clicked. I said, aha.
3 weeks later, he quit. And he got a customer service job at Blue Cross Blue Shield, even though his paycheck went down. He's still there today and says he's made peace with his financial reality. He's married, owns a house.
Hey, puppy.
With a big dog and a small daughter.
Birthday party, so yeah. They're balloons.
And to make all this happen, Calderon has borrowed and paid off his credit cards by raiding his retirement plan. For him, that's the price of graduating into a recession that caused the economy to shed more than 8 million jobs. And still?
And I'm way, way, way better than what my parents ever were. And not being happy about where I'm at, not being happy to enjoy the blessings that I have would be a disservice to the sacrifices that both of my parents have made.
Today, he's a supervisor at work, but still far short of his ideal starting salary from a decade ago. In Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an anniversary of sorts, which, to be honest, I wouldn't have known about had I not seen it on Bloomberg this afternoon. May 22nd is the anniversary of the first ever Bitcoin transaction. May 22nd, 2010, two pizzas were bought for 10,000 Bitcoin at today's exchange rate of $8,200, give or take, to the Bitcoin. That is $82 million worth of pizza. All right, we got to go. The Dow is off 0.7%. Today, S&P 500 down about 0.3%. NASDAQ also down about 0.2% there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.